Counselor, are you all ready? If our clerk will call the next case, please.
The court will now call Chance William Moore versus the State of Texas. May it please the court, Mr. Brian Salvan will argue for the appellant. Mr. John Mascunas will argue for the state.
May it please the court, start off by stating that back, but I could listen to tax and all day. In my brief in Chief Ward, I have five issues that we bring up, and I'll start off by kind of giving a roadmap of what I found going on. I think the most important issues would be number one and number five. Number three, I'm just going to skip on the merits of my brief on that issue. In criminal law, two things that are very important dealing with a criminal case, especially for the defense, is to have all of the information available to you that you can. And that comes by two ways. One is by the investigation that you do as an attorney, but it also comes by the investigation that the state does. You all know by law, the state has to turn over any kind of exculpatory evidence that they may come across. And throughout the years, the law has been made so that certain safeguards are put into place to ensure that the state does that. And most recently, you have the Mockingbird Act. And so I'm kind of going to go backwards and start with number five, because I think that's really important that the state in this case had failed to disclose a report to the defense. And by failing to do that, it prevented the defense from using that material effectively because it was provided to him late. It's very akin to trial by ambush. The state brought these charges. This case did not happen overnight. They had plenty enough time to provide all the evidence to the defense, and they failed to do that. And that evidence was material because the results of the proceedings, in our opinion, would have been different had the defense had some time to not only review that information, but also call witnesses who were directly a part of that information.
Is the state correct that trial counsel didn't ask for a continuance when this material was finally disclosed?
Well, I think what happened was that the defense did ask for some time to review it, and so in that sense, that is a continuance. I don't necessarily know if the state asked for them to suspend the proceedings like for a few days or a week or what have you, but he did ask for some time to at least review what he had, but once again, he's in the middle of a fight about it, hence the whole term of trial by ambush. Once again, had a substantial and injurious effect in determining the jury verdict because the testimony at the trial did not comport to that report that suddenly shows up in the middle of trial. You have not only the Michael Morton Act to prevent that, but you also have Brady, Supreme Court case, which is just a very simple roadmap to try to keep these trials fair, tries to make it to where an innocent person, one is not getting convicted, but also to make sure that people get a fair trial, get a fair shake at this. So that's the first one. The second one, when I jump to the first issue, is the extraneous offense testimony. This is also extremely important because what we don't want is for a jury or a judge, but in this situation, simply talking about a jury. We don't want a jury to convict someone of a present offense based upon past activities. And that's That's huge in criminal law. And in this situation, that's exactly what happened. The judge allowed some testimony in that was extraneous testimony. And I'll be very honest with you, I'm trying to be as broad as I can in the sense that there's so many aliases that I don't want to get tripped up on it. But there were two individuals that testified, and the aliases were LB and AB. And LB was giving testimony of a prior act, which was an extraneous offense. And really, there were no similarities between that and the present victim, that being AB. And so, because it was not, there just weren't identical allegations, it really put the defense, this defendant, in a terrible situation, because now he's being judged not on what happened on this occasion, not on the charges that are being brought, but being judged on things that happened in his past.
Well, how similar would you say that extraneous offense testimony needs to be to the charged offense? I mean, because obviously the state, in their brief, they take it up to a more abstract level, the comparisons between AB and LB's situations. What is your view on how detailed and how specific and comparable they need to be?
I would think for similarity, at the very least, be the same offense. In other words, you may have a situation where someone is charged with murder, and you may have someone charged with, let's say, involuntary manslaughter. The state can't come in and say, hey, simply because people died in both situations, that's close enough. I mean, if you want to show similarity of murder, then I would think that it would have to be something akin to murder. Or in the manner or means of which it was crime was committed. In other words, if you have someone who, let's say, committed murder by stabbing someone, and you had an aggravated assault where that individual also pulled a knife on someone, that might be close enough. But two completely different offenses, I don't think that they can bridge that gap in that way. And I think that even in the state's own brief, they somewhat admit that they needed that extraneous offense because they didn't have anything else.
Well, didn't they say that they needed it primarily because the defense was basically fabrication?
They did say that in their brief, but they also admitted that there was no physical evidence of sexual abuse of AB absent LB's testimony. It would have just come down to AB's word against the defendant. So, to me, that is a glaring red flag that, hey, we probably would not have won this case, but for the fact that we had to bring in this extraneous offense to make our case. And that, to me, also is almost an admission of how it harmed the defendant, they can't come back now and say it was harmless error, because it was harmful. Had they not had it, then it would have changed the playing field completely, and they admit that. And so, you know, that is why the law is the way that it is on extraneous offense, is to try to avoid a situation just like this. I don't think that the legislature intended that if the state, that if they were only close, or they felt like they couldn't make their case, trying to badmouth and bring similar, well, I can't say similar to what's similar, but other instances in to try to influence a jury to find the individual guilty of this offense based upon their past offense. In issue number two, clearly a hearsay statement. While we recognize that there are exceptions to the hearsay rule, one of the things that the state would have had to show was that that hearsay would be reliable. And we contend that it wasn't reliable because the outcry was in response to the father's inquiry. And that was harmful error as well. I think one of the main and important issues on, or one of the main important points on issue two is that the outcry statement provided evidence of facts that the own child's testimony did not include. So you have a situation where the statement says one thing, the person who makes the statement says something completely different. I would assume that's the whole point of the hearsay rule. You want to try to get as close to the truth as you possibly can, and by having someone else relay a statement that they heard, whenever you can get it from the actual source, and then you find out that those statements are, I don't want to say in conflict, but different.
That just go to the weight of the evidence, though, or how the jury considers the evidence, rather than whether the admission of the statement itself, or
based upon the weight. Yes, absolutely. Because you're given an opportunity, especially in a case like this, when you're dealing with a child, you're given the opportunity for an adult to, in my view, clean things up a little bit, try to make things more clear based upon your point of view, maybe not exactly what happened. And where the state kind of gets caught on this is because they were different.
Well, the dad testified first, is that right? Okay. So dad says one thing. When the child, who was, I think, only four at the time that these things allegedly happened to him, when he comes to testify, what he said didn't match what his father said he heard. But so the jury was able to see both of these witnesses and decide credibility issues by hearing from both of them. I mean, it wasn't just a situation where you had the father's hearsay testimony and that was it, right?
Yes. But that, in my opinion, that still doesn't, now what you've done is somewhat confused the jury. You have this hearsay statement that is allowed in, which if the state had intended to call the jury, that was going to be the best evidence anyway. So if they're intending on calling this four-year-old, why would they even need a hearsay statement? Because they're going to get it right there from the child. Except for the fact that if the state felt like what the child was going to say was not going to secure a conviction, then they would bring in someone else to come in and make a statement to try to clear things up. And that's the whole idea of hearsay. You can't have someone else come in and tell a jury what they heard from someone else. And I know I'm running out of time, so I'd like to get to the fourth one. My fourth issue, and I'll be brief, that we also contend that the state did not fulfill the elements of the offense because one of the offense was intent. And while intent can be inferred, there still has to be some evidence put forward to get to that point. You can't just say that, well, we talked about things and so therefore we inferred intent. You still have to put some evidence forward. And they didn't do that. And so that's kind of the basis for our sufficiency of evidence on our fourth issue.
I did have one question on your third point about the election. Are you continuing to say that that count, because as I read count one and count five, and of course the state dropped two, three, and four, because the specific allegations charged in those counts in the indictment were really rolled up into one, the continuous sexual abuse. But where count five did not have the same factual allegations as count one, what was the state, in your view, supposed to elect? What was their duty upon request to actually choose?
The manner in which they were bringing the charges. In other words, were they going to allege were they going to allege the touching of the buttocks? Were they going to allege the touching of the breast? It's just kind of what exactly are you getting at so that the defense would have an opportunity to respond. And because of the inflammatory nature of any type of offense against a child, it becomes important to the defense to know exactly what the state is going to allege, as opposed to having this just hodgepodge of things out there and allowing the jury just to pick which one they want.
Hope that answers
your question.
Thank you. Mr. Miskunis?
Good afternoon. May it please the court, counsel? John Miskunis, arguing for the state of Texas. Rather than just sit here and read from pages of notes, I would like to start by just asking the panel if you have any specific questions for the state right off the bat. Are there any concerns? If not, then I will go through this point by point. No? Okay. In point of error one, appellant complains that the trial court erred by admitting prior bad act testimony because it was irrelevant and unfairly prejudicial. And Justice Kerr asked about or mentioned that the state went a little more abstract in comparing the extraneous act to the charge act. I really don't think it was all that abstract. What we have in this case are two victims that were young girls that were that visited the same babysitter, were attacked, were sexually assaulted in the babysitter's residence by the babysitter's son. And that right there should be enough to make it relevant to show planning and preparation, which goes to show intent. And they both described that he touched breasts, he touched vagina, and then he directed them to touch his penis. I think that is very similar. So I do take exception to counsel's classification of them being completely different. As far as the unfair prejudice, the state will rely on its analysis contained within its brief, unless the panel has any specific questions. Pardon.
Thank you.
Thank you. Now, in point of error two, I thought this would be one that would probably garner some discussion. What happened here is that the state gave a notice of outcry a month before trial, and the notice of outcry was very specific. In fact, many of the statements tracked exactly what the dad's outcry testimony was. And JJ took the stand. He was available for cross-examination on that statement, and appellant chose not to. Now, I would consider that to be trial strategy. I think it's sound trial strategy. You don't want to alienate the jury by picking on a five-year-old. But that does not rise to the level of reversible error. JJ testified without objection, consistent with the outcry testimony, that appellant touched his middle part, which they established was his penis, with his hand or with his finger, meaning at least that part of the outcry statement was harmless. And I think that the state waiving the counts that applied only to JJ in front of the jury probably sent a message to the jury that, you know, maybe you should concentrate on the other victim. And the state did not mention the outcry in its closing. The inconsistencies between his testimony and the outcry, I don't see how that would be harmful to the defendant's case. In fact, I think it would probably help the defendant's case because it would undermine JJ's credibility. Point of error three, the state will rely on its brief unless the panel has any specific questions about point of error three. And the same for point of error four. It's my personal opinion that a legal sufficiency analysis is just best determined by just going over the record. Now, I can sit here and read off bullet points to you what I think is important in establishing the intent, or at least in allowing the jury to infer intent, but they're all contained in my brief. And point of error five, the complaint here is that the state violated Brady and Morton by its late disclosure. It was a disclosure of a document during the punishment phase. And it is well accepted law in this state that to preserve a discovery complaint based on late disclosure or unfair surprise, that the defendant must request a continuance. Now, he did ask for time to read the document, which the court granted, which I would argue that any discovery error on that document up to that point was cured when the court gave him the relief requested. But I would also argue that the Code of Criminal Procedure has a very specific procedure about requesting continuances, and appellant didn't follow it. So we would still argue that this has not been preserved. If it was preserved, appellant did not make any showing of materiality, exculpation, mitigation, impeachment value, or prejudice. And the trial court even pressed him and said, tell me what the impeachment value of this document is, because I've read it and I don't see it. I don't see the inconsistencies you're saying. And counsel stood silent. Then the court went a step further, admirably so, I think, went a step further and said, look, just because I don't see it doesn't mean it's not there. You're free to question this witness about any inconsistencies between the document and her prior testimony, and appellant didn't do it. I would consider that a waiver of this point of error. And he specifically rejected any remedial measures short of a mistrial. He actually said, nothing but a mistrial will cure this. I think that's an indirect way of saying, I don't want a continuance. But he still is supposed to request the continuance, and he didn't. So if there are any questions on point of error five, I will entertain them now. No? I will thank the court for its time. Thank you, counsel. And any time I have left over, I'll return to the court.
Thank you, Mr. Miskunis. Mr. Salvant, rebuttal?
Yes. The state asks the three of you to assume quite a bit. He's injecting his own thoughts and ideas into what actually happened. And I guess what we're saying is just look at what actually happened. I'm not asking you to assume. These are the things that just actually happened. You know, as the defense, as you know, we kind of have two things that we have to do is, one, show what the error is, and then, two, show that it's was it harmful. And throughout the state's brief and also in their argument, a lot of times they admit it happened. And what they're really giving us, the first prong of good, was there a hearsay statement? Yes, there was. There's no doubt about that. So the question becomes, well, was it harmful? And it's very obvious that it was harmful.
Just ask a question just to make sure it's clear to me? Okay, so you're referring to the outcry statement I can't remember his initial, that he testified to before JJ went on the stand, is that right?
Yeah, Yes.
And that's what you're saying is the hearsay?
Yes.
Because you don't believe it qualifies as the outcry that would take it outside the barriers of the hearsay because of its reliability? Is
yes.
that, okay,
yes.
All right.
And that is one of the things that the trial judge was supposed to weigh, was the reliability of that statement. And it's obvious that he didn't, because if the trial judge had weighed the reliability, the minute that the trial judge knew that it wasn't reliable in that it was different, the statement was different than what was being testified to, then it should have been, that should have been the end of it right there.
Okay, well, so
yeah, tell me how that was going to be the end of it. How procedurally would that play out?
Well, I think that whenever there was the objection made to that, then it should have had a hearing outside of the presence of the jury. So the judge could determine whether the statement was reliable.
But the court couldn't have known anything about its reliability until JJ actually took the stand. I mean, in other words, when the father's relating the outcry statements to him, the court didn't know then whether it was reliable or not, did it?
I would just state that once the objection was made, they should have been decided on whether that statement should have come in. I don't want to, sit here and try to go through what was going through the judge's mind at that exact moment. But
procedurally, let me follow up. I want to make sure I understand when the objection was made. Was the objection made at the very beginning when the outcry testimony was going to be brought on, before JJ ever testifies, when...
So
maybe he finds, well, it seems reliable because we don't have anything else, right? And then when JJ testifies and it becomes clear that it's different, was another objection made then?
Or
a request an instruction or something to disregard that prior outcry testimony? Or
I believe that there was an objection made at that time as well. And I know back to issue one that I want to respond to the state is that while the state makes these tensions that it was very similar, it really wasn't. I mean, an injury to a child charge versus a sexual assault of a child charge is completely different. And there was no real similarities there. And so, you can't just say that, hey, because there was a child involved, and that makes it similar, so therefore these extraneous offenses can come in. They can't. Those are two completely different offenses, whether it's an improper touching or an injury to a child, as opposed to a sexual assault of a child. So there were no similarities there, and that extraneous testimony should have been excluded.
Gentlemen, thank you very much for your arguments. We appreciate them, and our clerk will adjourn court.